Look, as a responsible user of these models, you should never expect to rely on being able to see everything that you are provided for. You should not put the safety and security of your application in the hands of the model provider. You should not necessarily even put the accuracy in the hands of the model provider. These models should never be deployed as a serious application naked.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of some of the most brilliant minds in technology to banter, analyze, and argue our way through the exciting news each week in artificial intelligence. Today, I'm joined by a great crew. We've got Marina Danilevsky, Senior Research Scientist, Nathalie Baracaldo, Senior Research Scientist and Master Inventor, and Sandy Besson, joining us for the very first time, AI Research Engineer. Welcome to all three of you. We have a packed episode today, as always. We're going to cover AI welfare, new findings on reasoning models, GPT-5's hidden system prompt, and this new report coming out of the MIT NANDA initiative on AI pilots. But first, we're going to do the quick headlines as per usual, and we've got Eileen here, so over to you.
Hey, everyone. I'm Eileen McConnon. I'm a tech news writer for IBM Think. Before we dive into our main episode today, I'm here with a few AI headlines you might have missed this busy week. First up, where should you head this week to catch a bagel, a slice, or a honey deuce? The US Open, of course. The American Grand Slam tennis tournament kicked off this week with the mixed doubles championships. This year as well, IBM and the USTA have rolled out various new AI-powered features for fans, including Match Chat. So Match Chat's an interactive chatbot that answers your questions such as, who converted more breakpoints that last set, or where can I find the nearest honey deuce? Which, in case you were wondering, is the US Open signature cocktail. It has raspberry lemonade, vodka, and melon pieces shaped like tennis balls. Meanwhile, Meta is restructuring yet again. Mark Zuckerberg told Meta employees he plans to split its AI division into four smaller units. He's going to break out superintelligence into its own division with a dedicated team. Superintelligence, by the way, is a new, pretty loosely defined term, meaning AI that's smarter than humans, not to be confused with AGI, or artificial general intelligence, which generally means AI that's as smart as humans. And last but not least, Robot Olympics? That's correct. This week, robots from 16 countries competed in running, kickboxing, soccer, and more at the first humanoid games, hosted in China. And while robots have certainly improved productivity in a variety of industries, from manufacturing to agriculture, these robo-athletes are still perhaps lagging behind, not to mention running into each other and some human fans at this week's humanoid games. Do you want to dive deeper into some of these topics? Subscribe to our Think newsletter. It's linked in the show notes. And now back to our main episode.
So for our first segment, we're going to talk a little bit about this report that was just published out of MIT's NANDA initiative. And so what they did was they conducted 150 interviews, a 350 employee survey, analyzed 300 public AI deployments. And there's a lot of kind of interesting findings that came out of the report. But the headline that everybody's been sharing around has been this claim that 95% of generative AI pilots are falling short, basically, not really anywhere near the expectations of the people implementing them. And this is coming out of some of the biggest decision makers at large enterprises, CFOs and what have you. And so I guess maybe the first question, and I'll throw it to you, Sandy, because you're joining us for the very first time, is, are these results surprising to you? Is like 95% shocking? I know some people were like, this is the end of AI, but I don't know if you thought this number was overblown or really not that surprising.
I certainly don't think it's the end of AI. No,
that's good. That's good news.
No, I would really like to read the full report and especially see how they conducted the study, how their survey was constructed, who they were interviewing specifically. They mentioned interviewing many employees and leaders, but there's also different expectations from an employee and a leader on how things actually went. How they're identifying the use cases, how they are implementing them, and whether they're and like the skills gap essentially of who is implementing them and do they have the capabilities to implement it correctly. And lastly, like, how are they even measuring ROI? So there's like so much unknown in this space. The number 95% in a way doesn't shock me, but it seems too high for what I think the capabilities of this technology is. So clearly there is a misalignment somewhere, and without reading the full study, I don't know where, but enterprises seem to need help.
And I think that's a point really well taken. I mean, I think one of my reactions on kind of reading the headlines was, well, look, I mean, you know, what do we even mean 95% of AI pilots, right? Like, what is an AI pilot? Who's responding to these surveys? Sandy, to your point, like, how are you measuring ROI here? I guess, Marina, turning over to you, I mean, is a number like this even useful as a way of thinking through the space? I think there's maybe one point of view, which is this is just way too simplifying of the situation.
A number like this is useful to get people to want to read your report. Nice.
That's
quote, right.
Yeah, exactly. That's why we're talking about it. So I guess it's
why we're talking about it.
Front.
So good job, guys. Well done.
Yeah, good job. MIT NAND initiative.
I will say that I'm not maybe necessarily too surprised that it would be pretty high, because there continues to be a misalignment of expectations of what, like you guys were both saying, what is it that the AI pilot is supposed to accomplish? And in particular, there seems to be a misalignment between leaders and maybe C-suite executives and what they have been maybe seeing through some marketing, some really specific demos, anything of that sort, and then what ends up actually happening, which will fall short of that. There are lots of things that AI is useful for, and even the coverage of the report says that the successful deployments are ones that are focused, that are scoped, that are actually addressing a proper pain point, not step one, we're using AI, step two, what for? And those end up being successful, if albeit sometimes less sexy as use cases. It's going to be back-end optimizations and things of that nature. So again, this is maybe a comment on the misalignment of expectations and how those should be changed around so that we can actually use the technology for what it's good for.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. And I really do love that interpretation of the results, which is this is almost a signal of like executive hype more than it is necessarily an indication of like the effectiveness or usefulness of AI. It's basically like, well, we were sold this thing that's going to change everything, and hey, it's not changing everything, so what's up? Nathalie, I think one of the interesting aspects of this report was, in effect, there was kind of a conversation about this learning gap, right? Which I think is like, at least again, from anecdata, from like working with companies who have been doing AI pilots, really does seem to be a really big question, right? Like both the learning gap in terms of how you use these tools, but then to Marina's point, like, do the executives even understand what it is that they're trying to solve? Also seems like a really big problem. I guess the question for you is like, do you feel like one of the big problems of technology in the enterprise, it seems to be like it's actually like a knowledge problem or an expectations problem more than anything else. Is that one way to read these numbers?
Well, it's I tried to read the report. It's not public, so it's difficult to fully provide a good assessment of what's going on with those results. That said, one thing that did caught my eye as I was reading the article was that basically they were talking about how we have processes and injecting the AI into the processes. It's going to be slow. We all know that it takes time to modify how people work. So sometimes I believe that as the process is more complex, we would have to inject those tools carefully. And that may be the reason for which we're seeing that number. But this is pure speculation. On the other hand, anecdotally, what I can tell you is that a lot of people right now are using AI for all sorts of tiny optimizations throughout the day. So it's very difficult to actually see how it all improves the productivity. I will give you an example. A lot of people right now are utilizing it to, for example, convert from one format to the other. It turns out that the models are getting very, very good at that. And then converting and automating all these sorts of little things, it's going to basically improve how fast we work and how we do things that are very repeatable and that we humans are not necessarily great at. So looking forward to read the full report, but that was my take. Obviously, it's going to take a long time to add to very complex processes, but I do see how people are starting to adapt our AI systems and models to their daily lives.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a perverse outcome, Sandy, because I feel like, Nathalie, I agree with you, but almost like one argument is like, is ROI the wrong way of thinking about these technologies right now? In the sense that like most of the uses really are going to be kind of small optimizations that people are using in their daily lives, which really have an improvement, but are really difficult to measure. And so almost it kind of sounds like from the point of view of the decision maker, they're like, why isn't the needle swinging radically in one direction? When the answer is, well, it's just because like it's creating improvements, but ones that you can't really see.
Well, one way you could measure ROI for impact, not necessarily in terms of revenue, but correlated to revenue, is internal adoption of tools, right? So are these POCs that are rolling out at these companies, are they being mandated or are they a tool that has been put out there, but we have Becky from accounting who's been there for 45 years that really doesn't want to use that tool, right? And so there's an aspect of the change management that ties into the impact of what, however you are measuring ROI.
That's actually a great metric for pilots, by the way, is like identify a cohort of the most tech adverse, tech resistant cohort within the company. Yeah. And if they adopt, then it's actually a win.
That should be all of our new benchmarks is like, yeah, you know, segment exactly. The laggards and then get them to adopt it.
Yeah, convince the toughest customer, basically. I'm going to turn us to kind of our next topic today. Kind of an interesting post by Simon Willenson, who we've referenced on the show before. He is a AI researcher, commentator, blogger, produces great stuff. I think you should definitely check out his blog. And he had this sort of intriguing post that I think, Sandy, you flagged for us, which was that, you know, in doing some digging, he sort of identified that GPT-5 not only has the system prompt you can edit, but apparently kind of a shadow system prompt that's operating in the background. And, you know, this is maybe less sinister than it sounds. He kind of uncovered what was in this system prompt. And it was largely kind of a setting around the verbosity of the model, right? Which is like, okay, if you're talking too much, we want you to set it to like a 3 on the verbosity meter, I think was the number. And so I think there's both this, which is kind of interesting, but I think the question I wanted this panel to kind of engage with was this really interesting comment that Simon had at the very end of his blog post where he said, this feels weird. If I am using a model through an API, I want to know everything that's going through the model. And so having these hidden system prompts is like makes me feel weird because I don't really have a full control over the process. And I think that's just so interesting about kind of like the ethics of how you structure these services and like what level of granularity users should have access to when they're using, say, an AI through an API. And so I guess, Sandy, do you have any opinions on that? Like, I don't know if like the discovery of a system prompt disturbs you at all or if it's just, you know, this is just like normal business and we don't need to be worried about it.
I think it was to be expected, right? If we look at just the way, at a lower level, the way that AI frameworks operate is that often when the developer is providing instruction to the agent, it's actually a piece of instructions that's getting inserted into a larger template of a system prompt that the framework developer has provided for the developer. So this concept or paradigm is not new. But I think it was interesting to try to get GPT-5 to unveil kind of its internal system prompt. And I actually tried my own experiment for a little bit and I was not successful, but I'm going to keep trying until I am.
Get it out, yeah.
it just kept telling me that it's not allowed to reveal its internal chain of thought or internal scratch pad. But from that, I learned that it also has an internal scratch pad. So maybe it's not doing a super excellent job of concealing all of its internal stuff by telling me what it will not reveal. But it's not a new paradigm or new concept. However, I agree that as someone who's building these systems out, it's important for me to know what is behind the scenes and how the model is being aligned and told to behave. Because if I'm providing, you know, OpenAI has this new concept of prompt hierarchies, right, where the system prompt comes first, and then we have the developer instructions or developer prompt, and then we have the user and conversation history and context. And they're kind of stacking the priorities, which makes a lot of sense. But if I, as the developer, am giving a contradictory prompt to the potential system prompt of the model itself, am I confusing the model? Am I going to get more variability in behavior or not the behavior that I want? And so I think that as a developer, it's very important for me to have as much transparency as possible. But again, they're a private company. They can do what they like.
Nathalie, why have a hidden prompt at all? Like, shouldn't OpenAI just kind of publish this prompt? Like, there's no need for us to be secret about this, right? Particularly in a world where, you assume that all these people will be very dedicated to like pulling it out of the system and being successful in doing so. Shouldn't every company just sort of publish its system prompt?
Tim, you are stepping into one very interesting topic, because in the security field, in the AI security field, we actually cannot fully agree on this. There are benchmarks specifically defined to test whether you can extract the system prompts. There are a lot of papers coming up with attacks to make sure you can extract the system prompt in the kind of idea of the system prompt may contain something that may be kind of hidden from users and may affect the users. And it's like this kind of threat model where you don't fully trust the provider. So there is that on one side. On the other side, there's this other kind of type of people that want everything to be transparent. And when you have transparency, the good thing is that, well, basically you can inspect it. You can see some companies are very transparent on what are their system prompts. I personally was not surprised to see that they did have a system prompt. I don't think it's anything too surprising, like modulating the size of the reply. It's something intuitive that we all knew would be added at some point in the infrastructure of the model serving platform. So from that perspective, I don't feel particularly surprised. We internally here at IBM are actually building something called Melia. And Melia is going to be, in a transparent way, allowing us to actually have more transparency into how these system prompts are fed, how we control the different types of replies that we are adding to the user, and having actually the developer of the application have control of how the replies are going to be modulated, and so forth. And we actually did have a release, I believe, last week on Melia. So if anyone wants to take a look at it, it's Melia like a fungus. So take a look at that. But I'm kind of deviating from the main topic, which
is... No, it's good. You should get your plug in. I mean, it's good to have people check it out.
So check it out. It's a very cool technology that we're developing, and it's transparent, basically, transparency.
One of the most interesting parts of this, I think, is it's a real question about, like, what should the user of an API have the ability to customize? And what is the kind of model provider responsible for or has rights to like not show you? And I think in particular, it's sort of interesting because the exposed bit of the system prompt is specifically about verbosity. And I guess, Marina, like that interface, I think, is really interesting, right? We're almost what OpenAI is saying is, look, when it comes to how verbose the model is, that's something that we get to control. That's what we get to make a decision on, and we don't really want you messing with it. And I guess we're really kind of debating like what the parameters of that are, right? Like, I guess there's a model which is, hey, we want this to be as customizable as possible for you as the user, but it's clearly not the decision that OpenAI has made. They say we actually want to control the sort of voice of the model in some sense.
Well, because the model needs to perform okay out of the box. And then you can go ahead and mess with it. I mean, they do let you change it. And if it gets, even Simon wrote, how do I basically change your verbosity? And the model said, oh, you can tell me to be concise, be more detailed, all the rest of it. The reality is they're going to have to find some ways, whether it's through fine-tuning, prompting, anything of that kind, to make the model still pass the vibe check and still do pretty well on benchmarks. But look, as a responsible user of these models, you should never expect to rely on being able to see everything that you are provided for. You should not put the safety and security of your application in the hands of the model provider. You should not necessarily even put the accuracy in the hands of the model provider. These models should never be deployed as a serious application naked. Put some clothes on. Put some guardrails. Put some programmatic intent behind it. Make it be a hybrid system that actually can get checks and get guidance and everything of that sort. Because what is in GPT-5 right now? All right, what's going to be in GPT 5.1 or 6 or anything of the sort? It's fun to try to pull these prompts out, but I'm not sure that it's makes any sense at all to say, oh, the company has that responsibility. You have your own responsibility to make sure that the way that you use it is going to be secure and controlled and as done by you.
Yeah, and I think that's maybe like, I mean, going back to the earlier conversation about like, well, let's buy the results for a while. Why are 95% of CEOs like, these pilots are not working? I'm curious how much of this is like kind of like the dream that the model provider would do it all for them, which is maybe like not actually the case and wouldn't even be a realistic expectation, right? I guess, Marina, you're smiling. I don't know if you've got
free lunch,
more you'd want to say.
Still can't find it.
Yeah.
Still can't find that free lunch, guys.
Yeah, exactly. Regrettably.
We are moving into a world, though, where the model provider is trying to provide more services. Now, not necessarily security or any of those things that the enterprise should always enact by themselves, right? Specific to them. But we have, even with GPT-5, more orchestration happening on the provider side. And there's this like ongoing conversation about, you know, how much now does the AI framework actually control and how much does the provider itself, the LLM provider, control? And so there's this, I think we'll see that play out over time, but we are seeing a shift in that space.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it goes to just how flat, I guess, ultimately the model provider thinks of itself as, right? Like whether or not this will be a situation where it's like, all we do is we provide, well, and I guess this is going to sound absurd already, right? Is basically like, all we do is provide intelligence. You customize and do all the rest. I think part of the problem is that like that concept itself is very lumpy and assumes all sorts of things. And so I think like this navigation of this line of like who controls what and who's responsible for what is a tricky one. It's going to take some time to really work out, I think.
As any good business, vertical integration is often a goal.
Where
right?
it goes,
you're
yeah.
going to be able to control more of the ecosystem, more up and down of what kind of thing you can provide. So, of course, things are going to move in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And Marina, is that a, I don't know if that's a vote in favor of like, ultimately, this is all going to kind of have to go open because people will really want to know everything that goes into the model end to end.
I don't know. I think just like saying, do you know all of the bits that go into any software that you 100% use, or do you still have some other things around it?
Yeah,
we're going to settle somewhere.
Guess,
we're pretty
right?
far from
yeah.
it. Yeah. yeah. We're going to settle somewhere. I think we're still a ways from it.
Yeah, I still think a little bit about, I remember when Apple first launched their Genius Bar, right? Way, way back in the day. And everybody was like, oh, it's so funny that computers, now you need to be a genius to go fix your computer. Whereas back in the day, I don't know, you'd like pop the tower open and just like make some changes yourself. And we're kind of like in that world, right? Which is basically like, well, okay, what's going to be like under the hood that you just don't think about? And you kind of don't care because you sort of trust that they're mostly going to get it right. Well, great. I'm going to move us on to our next topic. This was kind of a fun paper that kind of hit my inbox and was kind of in my group chats. And figured it would be a fun one to think about because we haven't talked about chains of thought in a little while. And so it's a paper that was entitled Large Reasoning Models Are Not Thinking Straight, subtitle, on the unreliability of thinking trajectories. And it's a fairly straightforward paper, but I think one of the most interesting findings kind of coming out of it is, you know, they're looking at the problem of underthinking and overthinking, right? Where sort of it appears that the model is like engaging in all sorts of chains of thought that aren't very productive, or they like prematurely disengage from promising chains of thought, which has been a known problem. And I think the main contribution of this paper, in my opinion, is they say, okay, well, how do the models really respond when we give them like hints or outright like solutions to the problems that they're trying to solve? And they find in many cases, the model just kind of like marches on, just sort of like ignores it. And so they kind of beg the question, which I continually try to wrestle with, is basically like, what's actually driving reasoning here if it turns out like the actual solution doesn't get or assist or change this kind of chain? And so very open-ended question, but I guess maybe, Sandy, I'll throw it to you. Have any thoughts on this paper? And I guess to that final question, it's just like, what is going on here? Like, why do these models just ignore apparent solutions?
First of all, when I read it, I looked at the models that they tested, right? So the three models that they tested were, I think, Llama 7DB, Qwen 7B and Deep Scale, I don't know how to pronounce it, R1 5B, right? And I noticed that they were all distilled in some way from DeepSeek's R1, right? And so although the paper was very thorough in some ways, I did notice that they were testing variations of a model that had all been distilled from the same kind of base model. And so I don't know whether there's any commonalities there as to the results that they saw. Now, they might have all been fine-tuned differently or, you know, had different methods to kind of changing the models. But that was one thing I wanted to flag. One thing I did notice that was really interesting was, you know, the cases that they picked out were specifically two of them that the model performed successfully as and actually took the recommendation of the correct answer when they injected it into the kind of chain of thought of the model itself. And at that point, it was always around kind of the 17th thought that they injected the correct answer in. And that led them to believe, which I kind of agree, especially maybe from the same base model, that this specific model needed to think for quite a long time before it settled on an answer. And that could have been because of a lot of things, and I'll let Marina and Nathalie kind of describe those more. But that was an interesting kind of revelation to me is, okay, now if I know that if I'm using potentially a model that's been distilled from DeepSeek R1, it thinks for a really long time before it makes a decision. And so I have to decide when I build with something like that, do I want a process that kind of thinks for that long, maybe waste that many tokens, or do I want to build with something that gets to the answer a little bit sooner?
Yeah, for sure. Marina, any comments, thoughts?
Sure. So I think I've mentioned before that I definitely have a stance that chain of thought is not the reasoning part. It's sort of a post hoc approximation, maybe a way to help reorganize the parameters a little bit, getting ready for the final. I will say, Sandy, I don't think this is limited only to the particular model they distilled from. I think this is something that is going to be true in general of the way they use chain of thought. Allow me to go on a tangent for a minute in the direction of people. So the really excellent podcast, If Books Could Kill, recently had an episode on Malcolm Gladwell's Blink. And I haven't thought about that book since I read it way back when it came out.
Yes, old school.
It is old school. But so he talks about a whole bunch of different ways that people make decisions, you know, system one thinking, system two thinking. And one of them was this description of an experiment of ranking jams, where there was a set of experts in the jam industry, which there are experts in the jam industry, and a set of students, and everybody was asked to rank jams two different ways, though. The students were asked first, give me just a ranking, 1, 2, 3, or 5, and just rank them in order. And then it was repeated again and said, oh, write down all of the reasoning and then rank the jams based on the reasoning. When it was the first way, the students really had rankings that aligned closely with the experts. And then when it was the second way, a lot of the expert ranking was now not aligned with the students. The students had talked themselves out of it. Don't know necessarily what this means, but it does seem that unlike, for example, in a math problem, where the way that we use language is probably a good proxy for how we're thinking through the problem, in many other cases, language, even for humans, when we explain our reasoning, that's not what happened in our brains either. This is a proxy that human beings are able to use. Why are we doing chain of thought as the proxy for what language models are being able to use? Well, we hope that we can read it. But let's be honest, even with ourselves, we aren't actually able to say that these words are the reason that I made the decision that I made. So it's also certainly not true for large language models. So it's just something to consider that if we are continuing to try to chase the way that we think that people behave, people don't behave that way. And again, no wonder we are happier trying to figure out what's going on with math problems, because that proxy is really, really close. Apparently, when you're ranking jam or when you're being asked extremely random questions at LM, not so much. And in fact, by trying to reason, you get yourself away from whatever you had initially thought in your head, with whether you're a person or whether you're a machine. This paper is in a set of interesting ones recently, and they cite some as well, about underthinking, overthinking, that, again, just really makes us think critically about the notion of chain of thought and how we're using it and what we're using it for. And so I appreciate that. I appreciate this topic coming up again.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess in that sense, maybe like the kind of interesting, quote unquote, result that I started with is maybe not that interesting by analogy to sort of like humans, right? Which is, I guess if I'm like explaining a story and I'm going down this line of thinking, and then you're like, Tim, have you considered the answer? You know, I might very well just be like, yeah. But like, I'm just keep doing what I'm doing, right? And I guess maybe the idea that these models sort of like ignore is not that surprising, particularly if you don't believe that it actually has anything to do with like the actual reasoning process, I suppose, right? I guess, Marina, and then I would love Nathalie's take on this paper is like, should we get away from the terminology chain of thought? It's a little bit too late, I guess. But it's kind of like, in the long tradition of AI terms that are really misleading, where we're sort of landing is that this too may be quite misleading.
This is in the tradition of the term hallucination.
Yes.
Of the term, like, answer AI. Relevance. AI in general. I mean, I don't know. I used to fight with people on this. I've given up. People are going to call it what they're going to call it. But no, it's not accurate. And so it may have something to, it probably does have something to do with what's going on. It's just not the whole story. And it is a proxy that is going to approximate an extremely complex space better at some times than at others. So look, we also only can communicate with language. We got to call it something. Sure. I don't know what to call it instead of it, and it's maybe no point. But I think, again, just continuing to keep in mind that this is an evolving field. This is an evolving understanding that we have ourselves of what's going on, and not think that the next thing is a silver bullet. First, everybody thought prompt engineering was going to solve it. Now it's like, all right, if we can just chain of thought our way into it, then we're going to solve that either. It's not going to happen. Continue to see these as incremental, interesting meanderings through the field. Nothing's going to be a silver bullet.
Yeah, for sure. That's good wisdom. Nathalie, hot takes. What did you think of the paper?
I actually really like that we're revisiting this paper because if you remember, Apple also had published a paper around these sorts of things like, hey, chain of thought is not really working as we expect. There's a lot of people trying to understand whether chain of thought actually gets us closer to understanding how the model is behaving internally. To me personally, it's not surprising that we are not seeing that kind of perfect chain of thought and analysis from the model perspective. On the positive side, and when I read it, I have this thing. I have to confess something. When something doesn't work, I get really excited because it means that we can make it work. So we are going to keep working on making this chain of thought happen. And I think it has to do with training data. I don't think it's magic. It's just probably the model did not see the type of training data for this particular analysis, and that I feel it's going to, it can be improved basically, depending on the type of problem that we're going to solve. And also it kind of hidden to myself, since I work in safety, one of the things that we have noticed is that when you include the chain of thought, sometimes you do get less safer replies in the final answer. So there's something that basically modifies and starts brainstorming a bunch of different, I don't want to use brainstorming because then Marina is not going to like my terminology.
You're doing it again.
But it's kind of the model is exploring. Let's call it exploring. I think brainstorming was too close to humans. But kind of exploring different solutions. We do see a lot of push, for example, right now to have chain of thought in the hidden space, not only in the token space, which I think it's going to be very, very interesting to see how it evolves. But overall, I just feel excited that it's not working because it means that we are going to make it work. And at some point, and there's so many people, bright people working on this and hidden space, kind of trying to get different sorts of solutions out there, analyzing it and have that aha moment that we all like, and we all hope that does exist when you have that chain of thought into consideration.
I'm a big fan of that optimism, and I think we'll definitely revisit this. I've been kind of thinking like we should make a point of revisiting the chain of thought literature every so often, just because I think it's like this just super interesting narrative that's running alongside certainly all the like commercial stuff that we talk about on a week-to-week basis. So this is great. For our last topic today, a very fun and kind of strange blog post came out of Anthropic. And it was so interesting, I wanted to make sure that we brought it into the discussion for this week's episode. It's a blog post that begins quite reasonably. Anthropic came out basically saying, look, in certain kinds of cases, particularly in these kind of distressing or toxic or kind of abusive conversations, you know, Claude's going to just shut down. We're going to allow the tool to make a determination and just cut off the conversation if it feels appropriate. We can go into what that means. And then it kind of goes into this kind of weird second act of the blog post where Anthropic says, and the reason we've decided to do this is because, quote, we have high uncertainty about the potential moral status of Claude and other LLMs. And so as a kind of first step in potentially protecting AI welfare, this is why we've kind of implemented this change, right? We don't want to put the AI, I guess, under the emotional pressure of these conversations. And so I was like, huh, all right, that's like a very interesting rationale I haven't heard before for a product decision. Nathalie, maybe I'll start with you. Thoughts on this? Like, it's kind of weird that we're here, right? That a major company is sort of justifying product decisions based on AI welfare. For our listeners, what should they take from this?
I think the term welfare is misleading here. If you think about it, all the time what we have been doing has been inspecting the model, whether it's activation, whether it's the output itself, whether it's the logits at the end of the tokens and so forth. All these things are inspecting the model. The welfare, if you think about it, is just the output of the model again. It's just a different name to express the same thing that we have been kind of using. So the model does know when things are not going the right direction in a lot of cases. And so I do find misleading the term because it kind of makes you think about the model as a person, which is not. It is not. To be clear, this is just next token prediction and a bunch of math behind the scenes that allow us to really get to that final reply. We're inspecting the model, and the fact that it gets shut down, it may be very good in some cases. So I think from my perspective, the fact that it was framed in that way kind of reduced the impact of what they are trying to do at the end of the day, which is stop conversations that are really going to be harmful for people. So I would have been happier if we had a situation where they just call it, we inspect the model state and we decide to shut down, as opposed to try to give it this kind of person-like situation for the model itself.
Yeah. It's exploring, just, not brainstorming.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And one thing that I found really interesting is, for example, the CEO of Microsoft replied with a really interesting blog post that says, like, hey, let's try to beat AI for humans and not to make AI a human, which I thought was a really interesting take on this particular news that you wrote today, Tim.
This question of harm, I think, is really where this is at. And Marina, it almost kind of feels like they've been like trapped in a framework of their own devising, in the sense that, like, you know, I used to work on a bunch of trust and safety issues. The reason you normally want to prevent someone from having an abusive or toxic discussion on your platform is that, you know, it's directed at someone who is being harmed. And so typically the justification is, well, we're gonna ban you from the platform because we're trying to protect our users. And here's kind of a weird case where it sort of seems like there is no user on the other side. And so there's almost a claim of, like, you know, I should be allowed to be as crazy and horrible as I want to an AI because who's being harmed? It's just me. And I guess there's almost one way of reading it, which is Anthropic's trying to, like, come up with some kind of justification for stopping this behavior, but, like, there's no one to point to in terms of harm. Do you buy that interpretation at all?
No, because no. This is a way to do a CYA, so that if something actually does happen and you're getting sued and it's all Anthropic, you made the platform available where a person could cause themselves harm. There are laws that we have about that in society. You still could be held liable. So this notion of liability is something that we've struggled with since the advent of the internet and even earlier, of to what extent is the provider liable for how people are making use of their product. If you're disseminating hate speech and other people, though, you don't have to read it, but you can still have a problem. You can still be banned off the platform. So no, there's still very much something going on with that. I will agree with Nathalie that I don't love the framing of this as an AI welfare problem. This continues to be a human welfare problem. And also to have a notion of people either continuing to over-humanize the AI when they read this kind of framing and continue to believe that they're talking with someone real when they interact with AI. And furthermore, work like this allowing potentially bad actors to figure out ways to shut down conversation when it is maybe not just about harm, but maybe something that is politically unliked or does not fit the notion of the narrative of your government or anything of that kind. So I would be really pretty concerned about being able to do that kind of thing under the narrative and the guise of AI welfare. So these are all things to consider. Funny blog post from Anthropic. Look, this is from the people who brought you Claude's vending machine that orders tungsten cubes. Like, you gotta give them
some
leeway.
You're saying we shouldn't be surprised.
Not surprised. I'm glad they're having fun with it. But yeah. When it comes to, you know, how other people report on this kind of thing, when we get outside of the valley, outside of a few engineers who are having fun and trying things, I think you have to have a broader and more responsible look on what this kind of framing means and whether this is really the best way that we should be disseminating what happened with, you know, a few engineers.
Sandy, so a lot to unpack here. I don't know if you would agree with Marina and Natalie about this on like AI welfare being kind of like a sideshow. Or actually, do you want to take the contrarian take that? Like, actually, we should take AI welfare seriously. I'm curious how you think about it.
You know, I agree. So I'm not going to take the contrarian take, but I have some friends who have very different opinions than myself, right? And some of them who are at Anthropic. And so I agree. I think it's a very tasteful way to allow Anthropic to essentially cover its, you know, and have insurance and liability. But some of my, you know, there's an overall take at Anthropic anyways. Like they launched their, I think it's economic figures program in June, where they're taking a look at just the economic welfare and social welfare of what the future looks like. And there is quite a large, like at any company, band of extremism in terms of who believes that AI will be sentient one day, right? And so they might just be like hedging their bets like insurance too, where if they do believe that one day it shall become sentient, at least they're laying the foreground to like, hey, I was nice to you. Yeah.
Right.
Don't come for me.
Well, maybe I'll throw out, I'm just curious about turning the crank one more time on the kind of like pro argument on this side. One argument that I've heard, which I kind of like is, well, you know, we're not certain about the sentience of all sorts of living things, right? Like we believe in animal rights that may have varying kinds of sentience. And so like, is it all that crazy to like take it seriously in the AI context? Marina, what do you think?
It's certainly one way to go about it. You could try to also say, what are you trying to do this for? Are you trying to actually cause harm? And what you think you're doing is torturing the AI, or what you think you're doing is you're trying to test it so that you can make sure that it does not cause some kind of harm. Intent probably has a long way to go here, but I don't know. I'm on the camp of people, as you know, that thinks we're still pretty far away from sentience as far as that goes. And I mean, maybe one day we will all welcome our AI overlords. We got some time. And, you know, it's almost like the difference between black hat and white hat hacking. Maybe we can have the right intent on it and then they won't get mad at us when they take over. I don't know, guys.
Yeah, but it's just too far away. Like, we're not even talking about anywhere
near other problems.
Animal sentience even, right? You're just like, it's just token prediction.
Yeah.
Well, great. Any final thoughts on this one? I guess, I don't know, when, maybe this is a good question to end on. I guess, you know, I think Marina, to your point, there's a lot of reporting around these kinds of stories. A lot of ability to get confused on what's going on, and a lot of hype around these kinds of stories. Do you have any advice for listeners who may hear these kinds of claims in the future? Like, see it all with a grain of salt? You know, how would you want people to receive these kinds of stories?
Look to history. There's very often nothing new under the sun, and very interesting technological innovations go through a period of excitement and in different directions before they settle into something that is useful. The perception that people who are in the thick of it have is not the perception that other people outside of the thick of it should have. And try to realize that as much as it's interesting what's going on right now, I don't think that from a social perspective, it's necessarily new. And I think I've spoken here before of the need for people to have a broad education, a wide understanding of what goes on besides just the technology. Also, why did this kind of technology get created by people at the time that it has in the society that we have? And just try to take it from that perspective as much as possible. And then try to get your news from multiple sources about it.
Always good one.
Yeah.
Well, that's good advice. And that is all the time that we have for today. Natalie, Marina, Sandy, thanks for joining MOE. And Sandy, hopefully we'll have you on in the show in the future.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll catch you next week on Mixture of Experts.